This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Lost and Found by Brooke Davis. Read for you by Nigel Carrington, Nicolette McKenzie, and Helen Walsh. Part 1.
Millie Bird. Millie's dog, Rambo, was her very first dead thing. She found him by the side of the road on a morning when the sky seemed to be falling, fog circling his broken shape like a ghost. His jaw and eyes were wide open, as if mid-bark. His left hind leg pointed in a direction it normally didn't. The fog lifted around them, and the clouds gathered in the sky, and she wondered if he was turning into rain. It was only when she dragged Rambo up to the house in her school bag that her mother thought to tell her how the world worked. "He's gone to a better place," her mother shouted at her while vacuuming the lounge room.
"A better place?
What? Yes, heaven, love. Haven't you heard of it? Oh, don't they teach you anything in that bloody school? Lift your legs. It's doggy heaven, where there's eternal dog biscuits and they can poop wherever they please. Okay, legs down. I said legs down! And they poop, I don't know, dog biscuits. So all they do is poop and eat dog biscuits and run around and eat other dogs' poop, which are actually dog biscuits." Millie took a moment.
"Why would they waste their time here, then?"
"What? Well, they, have to earn it. They have to stay here until they get voted over to a better place. Like Doggy Survivor."
"So is Rambo on another planet?"
"Well, yes. Sort of. I mean, you really haven't heard of heaven? How God sits up in the clouds and Satan's all underground and everything?"
"Can I get to Rambo's new planet?"
Her mother switched off the vacuum cleaner and looked squarely at Millie. "Only if you have a spaceship. Do you have a spaceship?" Millie looked at her feet.
"No."
"Well, you can't get to Rambo's new planet, then." Days later, Millie discovered that Rambo was most definitely not on a new planet, and was, in fact, in their backyard, buried half-heartedly under the Sunday Times. Millie carefully lifted the newspaper and saw Rambo, but not Rambo, a Rambo shrunken and eaten and wasting away. She snuck out every night from then on, to be with him while his body went from something into nothing. The old man crossing the road had been her second dead thing. After the car hit him, she watched him fly through the air and thought she saw him smile. His hat landed on top of the yield sign and his walking stick danced around the lamppost. And then it had been his body, cracking against the curb. She pushed her way through all the legs and exclamation marks to kneel beside his face. She looked deeply into his eyes. He looked back at her like he was only a drawing. She ran her fingers over his wrinkles and wondered what he'd used each one for. She was then lifted away from him and told to cover her eyes, because she was just a child. And as she wandered home the long way, she thought it might be time to ask her dad about people heaven.
"You see, Squirt, there's heaven and then there's hell. Hell is where they send all the bad people, like criminals and con artists and parking inspectors. And heaven is where they send all the good people, like you and me, and that nice blonde from MasterChef."
"What happens when you get there?"
"In heaven, you hang out with God and Jimi Hendrix. And you get to eat donuts whenever you want. In hell, you have to, do the Macarena. Forever. To that grease megamix."
"Where do you go if you're good and bad?"
"What? Oh, I don't know. IKEA?"
"Will you help me make a spaceship?"
"Hang on, Squirt. Can we finish this next ad break?"
She soon noticed that everything was dying around her. bugs and oranges and Christmas trees and houses and mailboxes and train rides and markers and candles and old people and young people and people in between. She wasn't to know that after she had recorded 27 assorted creatures in her book of dead things, spider, the bird, grandma, next door's cat Gertrude, among others, her dad would be a dead thing too. That she'd write it next to the number 28, in letters so big they took up 2 pages. My dad. That, for a while, it was hard to know what to do other than to stare at the letters until she couldn't remember what they meant. That she would do this, by flashlight, sitting in the hallway outside her parents' bedroom, listening to her mum pretending she was asleep. The first day of waiting. When playing Connect the Dots, Millie was always dot one, her mum dot two, and her dad dot three. The line came from deep inside dot one's belly, wrapped itself around dot two and dot three, usually watching the telly, and back again, to make a triangle. Millie would run around the house, her red hair bouncing about her head, the triangle between them spiraling around the furniture, when her mum said, "Would you stop that, Millicent?" The triangle roared into an enormous dinosaur. When her dad said, "Come sit beside me, Squirt," the triangle curled into a big beating heart. "Ba-boom, ba-boom," she whispered, skipping awkwardly to its rhythm. She nestled in between dots two and three on the couch. Dot three grabbed dot one's hand and winked. The flashing pictures from the telly lit up his face in the dark. "Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom." On the first day of waiting, Millie stands exactly where her mum points to. Right near the ginormous women's underwear and across from the mannequin wearing the Hawaiian shirt. "I'll be right back," her mum says, and Millie believes her. Dot two wears her gold shoes, the ones that make her footsteps like explosions. She walks towards the perfumes. Kaboom! Past the menswear. Kablamo! And out of sight. Kapow! The line between dot one and dot two tugs and pulls, and Millie watches it getting thinner and thinner, until it is just a tiny scratch on the air. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Millie will carry this around with her from now on, this picture of her mum getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It will reappear behind her eyes at different times throughout the course of her life. When movie characters say, "I'll be right back." When in her 40s she looks at her hands and doesn't recognize them as her own. When she has a stupid question and can't think of anyone in the world to ask. When she cries. When she laughs. When she hopes for something. Every time she watches the sun disappear into the water, she will feel a little panicked and not know why. The automatic doors of shopping centres will always make her anxious. When a boy touches her properly for the first time, she will imagine him shrinking into the horizon, far, far, far out of her reach. But she doesn't know any of this yet. What she does know, right now, is that her legs ache from standing. She takes off her backpack and crawls underneath the ginormous women's underwear clothing rack. Her mum said there are women who can't see their privates because they eat entire buckets of chicken. Maybe these undies are for them. Millie's never seen a chicken come in a bucket. "But I hope to," she says out loud, touching the undies softly. "One day." It's nice in there, under the giant undies. They hang low around her head, so close to her face that she breathes on them. She unzips her backpack and pulls out one of the frozen juice boxes her mum has packed for her. She sucks at it through the straw. In the cracks between the undies, she watches feet going for walks. Some going somewhere, others going nowhere, some dancing, others skipping, shuffling, squeaking. Tiny feet, big feet, in between feet, sneakers, high heels, sandals, red shoes, black shoes, green shoes. But no gold shoes. No explosion footsteps. A pair of bright blue gumboots plods past. She looks down at hers,
I know you're jealous, she says to them. But we need to stay here. Mum said.
She cranes her neck to watch the gumboots jump down the aisle and off into the toy section.
Well, she says.
She pulls out her book of dead things from her backpack, rips out a sheet of paper, writes on it.
To Mum, I'll be right back.
Folds it in half and props it up on the ground exactly where her mum had pointed to. She takes her gumboots for a walk. Up and down the escalators, walking at first, then jumping, hopping, and waving like the queen. She sits at the top and watches the steps swallow themselves.
What happens if the stairs don't flatten themselves in time? She asks her gumboots.
She imagines the stairs spilling out over the escalator and into the aisles. She tries to connect eyes with every single person who walks past her. And each time she does, the air jumps in front of her like the old movies her mum watches. She plays hide and seek with a boy who doesn't know he's playing. When Millie informs him that he is found, he responds by asking her why her hair is like that and makes spirals with his index finger.
They're ballerinas, she says. They jump off my head at night and do shows for me.
He says, and smashes a Barbie headlong into a transformer, making a spitty blowing up sound with his mouth at the same time.
They do not.
Millie sits on the floor of the women's changing room.
I know where you can get some undies, she says to one woman,
who's turning around and around in front of a mirror like she's trying to drill herself into the ground.
Sorry, who are you?
The woman says. Millie shrugs. Two ladies talk behind the door of one of the cubicles. Millie can see their feet in the gap between the door and the floor. Bare feet and sparkly Ugg boots.
Don't take this the wrong way, the Ugg boots seem to say. But do you really think coral is your colour?
The toes on the bare feet curl under themselves.
I thought this was pink,
they seem to say back. Millie waits with the waiting men, who wait in chairs outside the changing rooms, waiting for women, peering from behind purses and shopping bags like frightened animals. The walls nearby are covered with huge pictures of girls laughing and hugging each other in their underwear. The waiting men sneak glances at them. It occurs to Millie that the giant undies could be for these giant girls. She sits on a chair next to a bald man biting his fingernails.
Have you ever seen chicken come in a bucket?
She asks. He rests his hand on his knee and looks at her out of the corner of his eye.
I'm just waiting for my wife, kid, he says.
She stands under the hand dryers in the toilets because she likes the feeling of the wind whooshing through her hair, as though she's leaning her head out of a car on the highway, or like she's Superman circling the earth. How does the hand dryer know to start as soon as you stick your hands out? It is amazing, this, but the women in the toilets don't notice and just stare, panicked, into the mirror, trying to work out what's wrong with them before anyone else does. Sitting behind the plants on the edge of the department store cafe, she watches steam rising from coffee mugs. The man who looks like Santa and the lady with the very, very red cheeks lean over their coffees toward each other. They don't say anything, but the steam from their coffee kisses and dances around their faces and above their heads. Another man eats while not looking at his wife and has coffee steam that makes the most beautiful shapes in the air. Millie has never seen shapes like this.
Are there any more shapes left to make up?
The woman with the shouty kids has a coffee that breathes in and out, letting out long, tired sighs. There's a man in the corner with a tree bark face. He's wearing red braces and a purple suit, holding on to his coffee cup with both hands, as if he's stopping it from flying away. A fly lands on the plant in front of her.
What if everything could fly?
She whispers to her gumboots, watching the fly bounce from leaf to leaf. Your dinner could fly into your mouth and the sky could be covered with trees and the streets might switch places,
though some people would get seasick and planes wouldn't be that special anymore. The tree bark face man blows on his coffee so hard that the liquid spills over the edge and the steam splits in half. Some shoots forward and some upward. He stares deep into the cup for a few minutes. Then he blows on it again. He stands up. He has to plant both of his hands on the table and push himself up with everything he has. He walks straight past her. And Millie tries to connect eyes with him, but he doesn't look up. The fly follows him, buzzing around his body. He reaches out a hand and slaps it against his thigh. The fly falls to the ground. Millie crawls on her hands and knees towards the fly and scoops it into her palm. She holds it up to her face, squeezes her palm shut, and stands to watch the back of the tree bark face man as he shuffles away from the cafe and out the main entrance. Millie finds her backpack underneath the ginormous women's underwear. She takes out her just-in-case glass jar, puts it between her knees, unscrews the lid, and lowers the fly into the jar. She screws the lid back on and pulls out her book of dead things, as well as her markers.
Number 29, she writes. Fly in department store.
She can see DAD written backward in big letters through the paper. She taps the marker on her gumboots, picks up the jar and holds it to her face. In the crack between the undies, the mannequin looks down at her from across the aisle. His shirt is bright blue and has yellow palm trees on it. His eyes seem huge through the glass, like they're centimeters from her face. She moves a pair of underwear so she can see only his knees. Millie grips the jar while she watches for gold shoes all afternoon. And when afternoon becomes night, and the last door is clicked shut, and everything goes black, the air, the sound, the earth, it feels like the whole world is closing. She presses her face against the window, cups her hands around her eyes, and watches people walk back to their cars with other people. With husbands and wives and girlfriends and boyfriends and children and grandmothers and daughters and fathers and mothers. And they all drive off. Every single one of them. Until the parking lot is so empty it makes her eyes hurt. She crawls back under the ginormous women's underwear and takes a sandwich out of her backpack. As she eats it, she watches the mannequin through the gap in the undies. He watches back.
Hello,
she whispers. The only other sound, a humming from the lights in the display cabinets. The second day of waiting. Millie once thought that no matter where you fall asleep, you would always wake up in your own bed. She fell asleep at the table, on the neighbor's floor, on a ride at the show, and when she woke up, she was under her own covers, looking up at the ceiling of her own bedroom. But one night, she woke up when she was being carried from the car into the house. She looked at her dad through half-closed eyes.
"It's been you all this time,"
she whispered into his shoulder. On the second day of waiting, Millie wakes to the sound of high heels clacking toward her. She has spread herself out during the night, and her feet poke from underneath the clothing rack. She pulls her knees into her chest, hugs them, holds her breath, and watches the high heels clack past. Click, clack, click, clack, click, clack. They're black and shiny, and red-painted toes stick out at the ends like ladybugs trying to crawl in.
Why would Mum leave her under the undies all night?
Millie holds onto her stomach and peers through the gap in the undies. She knows why her mum might leave her there, but she doesn't want to think about it, so she doesn't. The mannequin is still looking at her. She waves at him. It's a careful wave, her fingers folding down one after the other until she holds them all in a fist. She's not sure if she wants to be his friend yet. She pulls on her gumboots, crawls out from under the undies, and looks up at the sign she stuck on the rack last night.
In here, Mum.
She tears it down, folds it up, and slides it into her backpack. The man with the tree bark face walks toward her. He shuffles down the aisle, straight past and toward the cafe. Millie follows and watches him from behind the pot plants. He sits down like it hurts and stares at his coffee. Millie walks over to him and puts her hand on his.
Have you seen chicken come in a bucket?
She asks. The man looks at her hand and then up at her.
Yes, he replies,
pulling his hand away from hers and tapping his fingers on the table.
Well,
Millie says, sitting down in the chair opposite him.
What's it like?
Exactly how it sounds, he says.
Millie bites her bottom lip.
Do you know many people who are dead?
She asks.
Everyone, he says, looking into his coffee.
Everyone?
Yes. Do you?
He asks, still tapping his fingers on the table.
Yes. 29 dead things, she says.
That's a lot.
Yep.
He leans forward in his chair.
How old are you?
He asks. Millie crosses her arms.
How old are you?
I asked first.
Let's say it at the same time.
87.
Seven!
He sits back in his chair.
Seven?
Millie nods.
And a half. Almost eight, really.
You're young. You're old.
The dimples on his cheeks are waking up.
Your boots match my braces, he says, tapping his fingers on his braces.
Your braces match my boots.
Millie looks at his hands.
Why do you tap your fingers when you talk?
I'm not tapping, he says. Tapping. I'm typing.
Typing what?
Everything I say.
Everything you say?
Everything I say.
What about what I say?
I don't do that.
Are you going to eat that?
She says, pointing to a muffin. He pushes the plate toward her. Millie shoves the muffin into her mouth.
Why won't you drink your coffee?
She says, mouth full, pushing his coffee toward him.
I don't want it.
He pushes it back. Millie wraps her hands around it and leans over it, feeling the steam rising beneath her chin.
Why did you get it?
It's nice to have somewhere to put my hands.
Millie smiles.
Oh!
She pulls her feet up onto the chair and rests her chin on her knees. Spread out on the table is a long line of small plastic squares, each one about the size of her fingertip.
What are those?
He shrugs.
You don't know?
He shrugs again. Millie leans over the table.
They're computer keys,
she says.
Like the ones on the keyboards from school?
She folds her arms.
But they're not on a keyboard.
Yes, he says.
So you do know,
she says.
They're all dashes from different keyboards.
He leans forward in his chair.
Do you know what a dash is?
Maybe.
You put them between two words to make one word.
Like what?
Like, he thinks for a moment.
Happy, sad?
Millie says.
Not really.
Hungry, sleepy?
No, he says. Like action-packed or blue-eyed.
But not happy, sad?
No.
Or hungry, sleepy?
No.
Why have you got so many?
There's lots of them lined up against each other in a long, straight line.
I collect them.
Why?
Got to collect something.
Millie thinks about her book of dead things.
I collect dead things,
she says. He nods. She holds his gaze as she nudges an index finger forward, moving one of the keys out of line. It hangs above the rest of them on an angle like it's mid-backflip. Tree bark face doesn't move.
They go between numbers too, she says, not just words.
She flicks another key and it skids along the table, stopping at the edge. He sucks in a breath and watches it as it teeters and then falls into his lap.
Don't do that,
he says, picking it up and putting it back in line.
Where did you get them all from?
Borrowed them.
From who?
Millie spots a screwdriver sticking out of his jacket pocket. He puts a hand over the screwdriver, shielding it from Millie's gaze.
No one ever suspects an old person, he says, smiling a half-smile. We're kind of invisible.
What's your name?
Carl, the touch typist. What's yours?
Just Millie.
Where's your mum, just Millie?
She's coming. She has gold shoes.
It is when she says gold shoes that Millie feels Dot 2 pulling and she holds her stomach. She shifts in her seat and puts the fly's glass jar on the table.
You made a dead thing yesterday.
Carl picks up the glass jar and studies it.
I did?
He says, tapping the glass. Millie nods.
I'm giving her a funeral.
The first funeral Millie ever held was for a spider her dad squished with his shoe. Her mum had jumped from one foot to the other and said,
If you don't squash that spider, Harry, I'll squash you.
Her dad stood up from his chair, wrenched off his shoe and slammed it against the wall. 1, 2, 3, 4. The spider slid down the wall and landed on the floor. Her dad picked it up by a leg, threw it out of the front door, sat down, and continued watching television. He winked at Millie from across the room. Millie couldn't bring herself to wink back. She watched her dad watch 3 whole shows before she said anything.
Can we give the spider a funeral?
She said as the credits rolled.
Like we did for Nan.
Funerals are for people, Mills,
he said, flicking through the channels.
And maybe dogs.
What about horses?
Horses too,
he said as a cricketer tried to sell him some vitamins.
Cats?
Yes.
Snakes?
No.
Why?
Because.
On the screen, a car wound its way along a beautiful mountainside. The whole family smiled at each other. They all had shiny teeth.
Trees?
No.
Why?
Because.
Centipedes? Planets? Fridges?
Millie! He said. People. Maybe big animals. That's it.
Why?
You'd be having funerals all day every day and we can't do that.
Why?
There's other stuff to do,
he said as a man on the screen looked her in the eye and yelled at her about mobile phones. That night, she packed a backpack with everything she needed, grabbed her flashlight from under the bed, and snuck out the front door. She found the spider on the grass near the driveway and picked it up with both hands. It looked different now, smaller and lighter and dried up by the sun. The night breeze circled around her hands and made the spider tickle her palms. A huge whoosh of wind lifted the spider right out of her hands. Millie ran after it, watching it high above her head. It flew through the air against the stars, over her front yard, out into the street, across the road, down the street, and into an empty lot. The moonlight illuminated its edges. The whole night seemed to be covered with moonlit spiders far, far away, pinned to the black sky. Then, just as quickly as it began, the wind stopped and the spider dropped to the ground like a falling star. A tree rose out of the center of the empty lot. It was the biggest tree she had ever seen, much bigger than even her dad. She put the spider into her backpack and climbed to the very top. The moon felt so close she could almost spin it around in circles. She straddled the branch, leaned her back into the trunk, and from her backpack pulled out the spider, an old Vegemite jar, a ball of string, a tea light candle, matches, and a piece of cardboard. Millie gave the spider one last look before placing him in the Vegemite jar on top of some tissues. She lit the tea light candle and put it in there with him, then wrapped a piece of string around the top of the jar, tied a knot at one end, and threaded the other end through the hole in the cardboard sign. She tied the string around the branch of the tree. The jar hung from the branch like a lantern, swinging a little as the tree moved. The small cardboard sign said,
"Spider, 2011, in her best writing."
Millie ran her fingers over the line in between the question mark and the spider's death year. Back and forth, back and forth. It was strange, she thought, that this line, this long, straight line, was all there was to show of his whole life.
Carl, the touch typist. Here's what Carl knows about funerals. Carl had never talked to Evie about her funeral. Why would he? It was too hard to get the words out. They were like a weight in his mouth. He just wanted her to live while he was living, and that's all he knew. So his son organized it for him. While Carl was busy remembering how to get up, brush his teeth, part his hair, chew. The funeral itself had been long, slow, repetitive. Before the service began, he was hugged, endlessly, by people he barely knew. He made sure their cheeks didn't touch. It didn't feel right to rest his palms on the back of someone who wasn't his wife. Carl sat in the front pew, eyeing the coffin, scarcely breathing. It felt strange to breathe when she couldn't. Flowers exploded from the coffin lid. He willed the coffin to open, Evie to jump out. Surprise! She'd have to high-jump the flowers. "If this is a practical joke," he whispered, "I won't be mad." He remembers standing during one of the eulogies. It was by the only friend from Evie's old work still alive. They kept dying, all their friends, as though they were on a battlefield, dropping dead in supermarkets, on bowling greens, fading out in nursing homes and hospitals. But this woman was still alive, standing at the lectern like God's gift, and Carl thought, "I wish you were dead." He walked toward the coffin. "Evie," he whispered, circling it and running his fingers along the edges. People were murmuring around him, but they sounded miles away. He pushed his face into the pine lid, closed his eyes, breathed in. "Evie," he whispered again, his lips against the pine. He had to know. He grabbed at the lid and flung the coffin open. She was dead in there. That was for sure, stone-faced in a way he had never seen. But he couldn't take his hands away from the edge of her coffin. Not when the priest tugged at his elbow, not when a gust of wind blew in through the doorway, not when the coffin lid slammed shut with such drama and force that it squashed his fingers. He didn't feel the pain, because there was pain everywhere already. And he wanted to type it, but they wouldn't let him because they were holding his hands to stop the blood. So he just yelled it. He yelled it as loud as he could. "I am here, Evie. I will always be here."
Millie Bird.
"The tops of some of your fingers are missing," Millie says, grabbing Carl's hand as they walk out of the cafe.
"Yes," he replies, tapping on her hand. "They are."
His mouth makes that line that adults make when they are most absolutely not going to talk about this one thing right now, and maybe not ever.
So she keeps her questions inside herself and puts them in the part that remembers things for later. She rubs the stubs of his fingers as she holds his hand.
Did he bite his nails so much that he bit his fingers right off? Did a family of mice eat them in his sleep? Or did someone chop them off because he didn't do what he was told? Millie's mum threatened her with that once, Millie remembers, when she was tapping her fingers on her dinner plate during Dancing with the Stars.
I'll rip those things right off,
her mum said, without turning around to face her.
Don't try me!
And Millie didn't try her. She hadn't meant to try her, and sat on her fingers so they wouldn't try anyone without her knowing. Millie leads Carl to the ginormous women's underwear, shakes off his hand, and crawls underneath. She slides the undies down the rack so Carl can see in.
What are you up to down there, just Millie?
He says.
I told you,
she says, unscrewing the lid of the glass jar. Millie unzips her backpack and pulls out her funeral pencil case. She removes a tea light candle and some matches and places them on the floor. She stares at them. After a moment, she holds them up to Carl.
Could you, please?
He glances around him. Should we be lighting fires?
Yes, she says.
Carl seems to consider this answer, then nods. Millie watches the wick catch fire and holds her stomach. She clenches her teeth and tries not to remember the night before the first day of waiting. She tries to put it in the part of her head that never remembers anything. She hands Carl the jar.
In there, please, she says.
Carl carefully lowers the candle into the jar and hands it back to Millie. She ties the jar to the rack and the fly dangles behind a row of flesh-coloured undies.
You need to say something, she says to Carl.
Me?
Carl says, pointing to himself.
Yes, you,
Millie says, pointing at him, pointing to himself.
You did it. You made a dead thing. Aren't you sorry?
Her head detaches itself and she's watching her dad squish the spider with his shoe. Was he sorry?
Of course, Carl says, putting his hands on his hips. Of course, he repeats. But, he says, taking a big breath, it's a fly.
Yes, Millie nods. You're right, it is a fly.
Carl looks down at Millie. Millie looks up at Carl. Carl sighs.
What should I say?
What would you like someone to say at your funeral?
Carl stares at his feet. I doubt anyone will say anything.
Well, Millie says, crossing her arms, you need to say something.
Why do you know so much about these things?
Why don't you? She says.
A fact about the world Millie knows for sure. Everyone knows everything about being born, and no one knows anything about being dead. This has always surprised Millie. There are books at school with pictures of mums with see-through stomachs, and she has always wanted to lift up the shirt of a pregnant lady just to see if it really is true that your stomach goes see-through when you are pregnant. This makes sense, she thinks, to give the baby a chance to get used to the world before it is in it, like a glass-bottom boat. Otherwise, what a shock! How scary the world would be if you didn't know it was coming. Millie has also seen the books with the cartoon people who love each other so much, and the man gives the lady a fish, and the fish gets inside the lady and lays eggs, and those eggs turn into a human baby. She knows the baby comes out from the place you pee, but she has not seen pictures of this.
After Millie goes swimming in the ocean, she always watches her pee carefully for babies, just in case. Adults want her to know these things, otherwise they wouldn't have given her these books. But no one has ever, ever given her a book about dead things. What is the big secret?
Okay, Carl says. The fly, loved by many, forgotten by none. He clears his throat.
God save our gracious queen,
he sings, so softly that Millie can barely hear him.
Louder,
Millie says, and he does.
Long live our noble queen, God save the queen.
Millie watches the feet walk past through the gap in the undies as he sings. Some of them speed up as they get closer. Some of them slow down. One pair of shoes stops completely.
Send her victorious.
He's really belting it out now, and his dimples are waking up again.
Happy and glorious, long to reign over us.
Carl raises his arms with a flourish, his fingers typing in the air.
God save the queen.
He takes a bow. The shoes, wide, black, clumpy, are still there in the aisle, and one foot is tapping. Millie brings her knees to her chest.
Are you quite done, sir?
A woman's voice says. Carl looks in the general direction of the shoes. His eyes widen.
Yes, thank you, sir. I mean, ma'am.
Arms grab at Carl. Push him down the aisle, and the woman says, Let's go! And Carl says, I'm terribly sorry. I really didn't mean to say that. I'm not intimating that you in any way resemble a man. Millie leans her body into the pole in the center of the rack. Carl says,
You're very ladylike, honestly. And then, Excuse me,
over and over again until she can't hear him any more. A lady nearby says,
What's all the hoopla about?
Millie mouths,
Hoopla,
as she packs up her funeral equipment. She pulls her backpack in close and makes her body as small as it can be, like the babies do when they're stuck in their mum's tummies. She presses her face against the metal pole. It's cold on her cheek. The fly's jar swings in some imaginary breeze, the candlelight making trails that disappear and reappear. She runs her fingers through the air, and it feels like nothing, but it keeps everyone alive.
How can that feel like nothing?
Through the gap in the undies, the mannequin's still looking at her, and she looks back. She likes the way he's always looking at her. It makes her feel like he won't let the clumpy shoes take Millie away too. Millie sits in this position until it's night in the department store again. Her feet sweat in her gumboots. Her knees stick together. The light in the jar is still burning, but only just. And the flickering shadows make the undies look like they're joining together at the edges, becoming one super enormous, ginormous pair of women's undies. And the super pair of undies circles around her head, getting closer and closer. And Millie is sure it is going to wrap itself around her and suffocate her. And then the light in the jar goes out, and Millie is breathing in too much air, and her cheeks are wet with tears. She buries her face in her knees and squeezes her eyes shut. She hears footsteps and thinks, Gold shoes, gold shoes, gold shoes! And her breath is so quivery, like the old people who breathe loudly just to let you know they still can. But it isn't her mum at all. Because the footsteps are sliding along the floor, and mum doesn't walk like that. The footsteps move toward her, and there's a flashlight shining everywhere. And now the flashlight is on the fly's jar, and the footsteps are so close to her, and the flashlight is still on the jar, and the footsteps have stopped altogether. And the flashlight is like a spotlight on the fly, like an alien spaceship trying to pull it up with a space beam. And Millie has to hold her quivery breath so that the alien beam doesn't get her as well. But then there's something in the corner of her eye, a sparkle of something beyond the undies, and the mannequin looks at her, and his eyes seem wider for some reason. And there's something in her stomach, something pulling. And it feels like Dot 3, but that can't be right. And then the mannequin falls forward somehow, and the sliding feet yell, "Ow!" And the flashlight clatters to the ground, and the mannequin is on the ground too. And he is still looking at her, and the flashlight lights him up, like he's on stage. And Millie feels a smile on her face just appear there, and she touches it with her fingers. She wants to touch the mannequin's face too, because he's smiling at her in the flashlight. Another fact about the world Millie knows for sure. It's important to have your mum. Mums bring you jackets and turn on your electric blanket before you get into bed and always know what you want better than you do. And they sometimes let you sit on their lap and play with the rings on their fingers while Deal or No Deal is on. Millie's mum is a wind through the house. She is always washing overalls or ironing undies or wiping lamps or talking on the phone or sweeping the driveway or putting sheets on things. Her hair is always sweaty and kind of crooked. Her voice is like a violin, like she is trying to lift something really heavy all the time. Millie is always getting in her way no matter how much she tries not to. So she has learned to sit against the walls and into corners, to stay outside, hide in bushes and up trees. Sometimes, before she goes out, Millie's mum disappears into the bathroom for not very long at all. Millie listens at the door, and it sounds like a factory in there with all the clanging and spraying and squirting. Her mum always reappears with coloured-in skin and magazine hair. A sweet smell follows her like a smell shadow. One day, when her mum went next door to the neighbours, Millie kneeled on the bathroom floor and opened the cupboard under the sink. There were things that squeezed and things that poured. They were all so patient in there. She lined them up in a row on the cold tiles, from smallest to biggest. She looked at this audience of cosmetics for a long time. "Ahem," she said to them. She picked up a lipstick and painted her earlobes and sprayed perfume into the air over and over again, just to watch the mist of it, and brushed mascara on her cheeks and rubbed blush on her fingernails. Her mum suddenly appeared in the doorway, and Millie tried to sit against the wall out of her mum's way. But she grabbed Millie under the armpits, plonked her on the bench, and wiped her face clean with a cloth. She brushed her hair straight, put lipstick on her lips, something on her eyelashes and something on her cheeks. Her mum was so close to her, and her voice was smiling when she swiveled Millie around to look at herself in the mirror.
"See?"
And Millie did see. She saw that she could be a different person if she wanted, new and improved. Now, on her second night of waiting, Millie decides to make herself new and improved. She wants her mum to walk up to her and say,
"Excuse me, madam, but I'm looking for a small child. Have you seen her?"
And Millie will take off her hat and wipe her lipstick on the back of her hand and say,
"Mum, it's me, Millie Bird."
And her mum will laugh and scoop her up and carry her out to the car. And Millie will wave goodbye to the department store.
"Bye, cafe. Bye, giant undies. Bye, pot plants. Bye, Carl. Bye, mannequin."
And her mum will drive her back home, and Millie will get to sit on the kitchen counter while they cut up vegetables for dinner. So she finds the nicest dress she can. It's yellow and feels like a cloud should. And puts it on over the top of her clothes. She goes to the wall of makeup, where small black plastic cases hang from metal hooks like they're bait. She picks the ones that are within reach and carefully applies lipstick, eyeshadow, and blush the way her mum showed her. She has to stand on a pile of books to see in the mirror. But she does it without once falling over.
"See?"
she says to the mannequin. She finds a floppy red hat, puts on green nail polish, looks at the shoes and knows her gumboots will probably give her identity away, but she's not taking them off. Not ever. She duct tapes 4 matchbox cars to the bottom of each gumboot and skates around the shop. She skates past the racks of bras, so many of them hanging there, lined up like soldiers waiting to be called into action. Millie's head detaches itself and sees her mum after the shower, her hair dripping and limp around her head, steam rising off her skin. Her boobs hang off her body like water balloons, and they try to hit each other when she walks from the shower to the wardrobe. She catches Millie watching her as she slides the bra loops over her shoulders.
"You'll have them one day," her mum says. Millie does not want them. Not ever.
She found some magazines once in her dad's bedside table. The boobs jutted out of the women's bodies as if you could unscrew the back like a brooch. They looked unpredictable, demanding. And then there was the naked woman who wasn't her mum, who hid in the bathroom one afternoon.
"You didn't see me, kid," she said.
Millie's eyes were drawn to her nipples like they were magnets. And Millie thought,
"Yes, I did."
She skates to the games section and one by one pulls board games off the shelf and lines them up in front of the mannequin. There's Twister and Monopoly and Guess Who and Mousetrap and Checkers and Backgammon and Battleship and Operation and Scrabble and Hungry Hungry Hippos and Connect Four. She doesn't really know how to play any of them, so she just rolls the dice once for the mannequin and once for her, and moves all the pieces around. And the battleships are trying to sink Park Lane. The Guess Who people are an audience for Mousetrap, and the hippos are eating the checkers.
"After you hit the man with the flashlight on the head, I followed him," she says to the mannequin,
putting a bra cup over her mouth and tying the loops behind her head.
"For hygiene,"
she explains, a bit muffled now, thinking of the hospital shows her mum watches.
"He went in there,"
she says, pointing to an office towards the back of the store. She puts Scrabble letters into the operation man.
"He's got a pack of peas for his head."
She delicately removes the letter M from the operation man's stomach.
"And he fell asleep. He left the key in the door."
She holds up the key and grins.
"I locked it."
Pats the mannequin on the head.
"I owe you,"
she whispers into his ear. For dinner, Millie invites the Guess Who people. The mannequin, a hobby horse. The Guess Who people might be less self-conscious if there is someone else there with just a face. And a toy dog who looks exactly like Rambo. She seats them at the biggest dining table in the furniture section. It is at least double the size of their dining table at home and doesn't have any coffee mug rings or candle wax or Millie's name written on one of the legs. The napkins and placemats and plates and bowls are all white and the same as each other. She hoists the mannequin onto the chair at the head of the table and sits Rambo on a placemat. The Guess Who people and the hobby horse stare at her from across the table. She likes how they look at her, as if they expect her to do something.
"Okay,"
she says, and skates away, returning with an armful